Well, good morning. Grace and peace to each of you as we gather today in the name of Christ. God calls Moses to deliver the Israelites from slavery in Egypt. But in order to hear and respond to this call, Moses must shift his perception of himself and the world in accordance to the character of the Creator God who calls him. And that's where we are going to go today. I appreciate hearing from Andrea, paying attention.
Thank you, Kevin. And as her introducer, I had asked our humble speaker a few minutes ago if I could say good things about her. She seemed reluctant, so you've set the stage well. Dr. Andrea Dalton Sainer is Eastern Mennonite Seminary and Eastern Mennonite University, Bible and Religion Department Professor of Old Testament and Hebrew language. Note that she does have a joint appointment, and I suspect that there are hearers here from both the undergraduate and the graduate part of her work, and we welcome you. Quoting from Andrea's personnel page, I like what she has put there. She says that through her research, she strives to offer the church resources for reading the Old Testament in ways that take seriously Trinitarian theological concerns without anachronistically imposing these concerns on the ancient text. She seeks approaches that honor Jewish readers and others who read the same texts well within their own interpretive traditions. Now, before coming here to EMU and EMS in 2013, Andrea completed a PhD in Old Testament at Durham University in England. She also earned degrees from Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary and from Messiah College. Andrea's dissertation, now published by Eisenbrowns, is called Too Much to Grasp, Exodus 3:13 through 15, and the Reality of God. And you'll note in your flyer that we'll be discussing it during the lunch forum today. In her dissertation, Andrea explores the relationship between translation and interpretive traditions in the Christian church, and between the name of God, the nature of God, and God's acts. I am trying to be good to our humble speaker, so I'll say this only briefly, but we just had a planning meeting at which Andrea's name came up along with others, but when Andrea's name was raised, it was noted that Andrea can always bring something interesting to bear on our lives today from the Old Testament. That's a testimony I hear regularly and a reality that I have experienced personally. So, Andrea, we are looking forward to what you share with us today. We have high expectations that you will strive to meet, and we ask God's blessings on you.
That being said, let's take a minute and to just be present in this space. And the question that followed her framing statement is this: how is God forming, transforming our attention? Spirit of Christ, draw our attention to your presence.
Thank you. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said,
"I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up."
When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush,
"Moses, Moses."
"Here I am."
"Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob."
And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God.
"I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt."
"Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?"
"I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain."
"If I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?"
"I am who I am." "Thus you shall say to the Israelites, 'I am has sent me to you.' Thus you shall say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this my title for all generations.'"
I began thinking seriously about this chapter in Exodus in November of 2009. When over coffee and beignets, which were very good, on the street, sitting at a table on the street of New Orleans, my then future PhD supervisor, Walter Moberly, and I considered whether I might write on this text for my dissertation. So I've spent the better part of 6+ years thinking about these words. And as a result of that, I can attest to the fact that there's a variety of things that one might say about Exodus 3. There are quite a number of things that have been said about Exodus 3, particularly about the last three verses, not only in the book that we'll be talking about, but also, and actually more importantly, far beyond that. Quite a lot of ink has been spilled on these verses. And I can also attest to the fact that 6 years' worth of thoughts on a passage is much too much for a sermon. So this morning, what I'd like to do is two things. The first is to guide us in a close reading of the passage, which you'll see on the opposite side of your order of worship. And the second thing is that, isn't really a second thing, but as we read, to reflect on two questions. Who is this God that Exodus 3 gives witness to? And how do we know this God? How does Moses come to know this God? And how might we also know this God? One of the things that has struck me about this passage as I've read and reread it is that it includes a lot of attention giving, a lot of seeing, and then also some hearing. The passage begins by telling us about a seemingly uneventful day in the life of Moses. He's out shepherding the flocks of his father-in-law. But on this day, Moses comes to the mountain of God, Horeb. Horeb, that is Sinai, is where God will later make a covenant with the Israelites. We're not sure if Moses knows that yet, at least not in verse 1. But we, the readers, know that, and so we're tipped off to this fact. Here is the mountain of God. Something important is going to happen. And something important happens. God appears in verse 2. The angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in a flame of fire out of a bush. And this is the first thing that's said about seeing. In English, of course, the word appear and see sound really different. In Hebrew, this is just another form of the word to see, so it sounds more like seeing and more like some of the other words that we'll observe in the passage. The angel of the Lord was seen by Moses. The next thing that happens is that Moses saw, and then there's a word that's not in the NRSV, but does exist in Hebrew. Possible translations of this word include looky here and shazam. Traditionally, it's rendered something like behold. So Moses saw and looky here. Moses saw and looky here, the bush was blazing, but it was not consumed. And what the looky here does, why it's important, is it shifts the attention, the reader's attention. So we're seeing this scene go by like the narrator, and it's happening kind of outside of us. And then the looky here happens, and what the looky here does is, like, if this were a film, it shifts the camera angle, and so now we're looking with Moses at the bush. So it's calling our attention to see the bush burning, but not consumed, surprisingly. And so with Moses, we're surprised, intrigued, maybe perplexed. Moses is at least interested, if not also puzzled in all of these other things, and says, well, I must turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned up. So we have two more seeing words. He wants to see the great sight. Thank you, Hebrew, for being repetitive. The Lord then responds also by seeing. The Lord saw that he had turned aside to see. God observes Moses' attention to the bush, and perhaps because Moses has paid attention to the bush, God calls to him. The character of Moses here at the beginning of our narrative is one who is alert, who pays attention to what is around him, and in doing so, Moses ends up paying attention to God. However, once Moses understands what's going on, he must turn and look away. God identifies God's self as the God of your fathers, God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And the text tells us that then Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. God appears to Moses in the angel, in the bush, and Moses is very interested in looking at the bush, but avoids looking at God directly. So much in the narrative seems to involve seeing, but also Moses is afraid to look at God, and this might be instructive. It could be the author's way of being careful to articulate the reality of God's manifestation there with Moses. God as creator cannot simply be seen or looked upon, for example, as bushes can be seen. And yet, God is truly present with Moses. God is really there, but still God. I said at the beginning that we would reflect on two questions: who is God, and how does Moses perceive God? So far, God is identified as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, the God of the Hebrew people particularly, who promised to make a great nation out of Abraham. Further, God is a God who appears to Moses and who speaks, but whose appearance must be spoken about carefully. God appears in the form of an angel of the Lord in the bush and cannot be looked upon directly. In verse 7, God declares that God's own attention has preceded the entire scene. I have surely seen the misery of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. The point of this, the point of the bush and the appearance of God, is that God has seen God's people and heard their cries. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob attends to the ancestors' enslaved descendants, the Hebrews in Egypt. God has seen and heard the Israelites. God knows their plight, and therefore Moses is to go. The Lord declares, "Go, and I will send you to Pharaoh in order to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." We've arrived, then, at the call part of this narrative, often referred to as the call of Moses. Like other characters in the Old Testament, Moses receives his call, this call, with hesitation. He voices his hesitation in the form of four questions, of which we have two in the segment of our passage here this morning. And as we've seen, the beginning of the narrative concerns perception, Moses' perception and of the bush, and God's perception of the Israelites and of Moses. Now, Moses' questions and God's answers will also focus on perception. Namely, God's answers demonstrate that God is trying to change Moses' perspective. The first question is, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Pharaoh, of course, is the great king of an empire. Moses, the descendant of the slaves of that empire, now in exile, now a shepherd. Why should Pharaoh listen to Moses? Because I will be with you. It's my translation of verse 12. God is not particularly concerned with qualities inherent in Moses, but rather suggests that God's presence with Moses is what counts. In Christian terms, we would say that the Holy Spirit will empower Moses' confrontation with Pharaoh. God asks Moses to perceive that God is with him as he goes before the king. Who is God in Exodus 3, and how does Moses perceive God? God is the deliverer of the enslaved Israelites about to fight against the Egyptian imperial king for the well-being of God's chosen, beloved people. Moses is to perceive this God with him as empowering him to do what he alone could not do, to carry out the will of God. The second question in verse 13 is similar in that it provides an opportunity for God to try to shift Moses' perspective. Yet, the second question is more difficult. Moses says to God, if I come to the Israelites, now he's not really agreeing to go along with the plan at this point, it's kind of a hypothetical, suppose I really do this. And then he engages in this thought experiment, which includes the fact that he seems to think once he gets there, he's going to be asked for a name of the God who has sent him. Perhaps the question was customary. In a polytheistic context, it might be important to know which God a prophet intends to speak for. Or perhaps it's some kind of test. God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the Hebrews, has this God, the God that the Israelites already know, truly appeared to this Moses? Either way, Moses is asking for a name, and what he receives in response is a name, eventually. Or it's not really a name, and then it might be a name, and then it's a name. There's a threefold answer. There are three parts to this answer. The first part, God says to Moses, I am who I am. What does I am who I am mean exactly? Many have pointed out that the I am part of this is the same in Hebrew as the I will be of the I will be with you back in verse 12. So in English, those don't look the same because one is in the present, I am, and one is in the future, I will be. In Hebrew, there's no difference, so it's the same word. But unlike I will be with you, I am who I am, or I will be who I will be, is not descriptive. Okay, you want the second part of the phrase to say something more concrete. You want, like, I will be good, or I will be powerful, or I will be your God. See how all of these are descriptive in some way? But I am who I am just sort of circles back around, doesn't take you anywhere. So what exactly is the point of this seemingly circular statement? One possible answer is that God is being cagey, evading an answer when God could give one. Haha, Moses. But as the passage continues, that doesn't really work because God eventually does give an answer, right? So the evasion question response doesn't really quite pan out. We eventually do give a name, the Lord, the four-letter name of God, spelled in English YHWH, which is the Lord with capital letters in your translation. It wouldn't make sense for God to act like God's not going to give an answer only to then give the answer. So we can't get out of exploring I am by who I am by saying that it is simply meaningless. It must be meaningful. In order to figure out how it's meaningful, first we have to look at the second part of the threefold answer. God said further, "Thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you." Whereas I am who I am is said only to Moses and doesn't appear to be a name, the I am of I am has sent me to you is meant to be communicated to the Israelites, and it does function, at least in that sentence, as a name, right? I could say, Kevin has sent me to you, and you put Kevin in the sentence where I am is in verse 14b here, and you get, it's a name. I am has sent me to you. But like the phrase, I am who I am is a name that's difficult to understand. And perhaps this difficulty is part of the point. This is what St. Augustine suggests when he reflects on the passage, which I'll quote. Perhaps it was too much even for Moses himself, as it is too much for us also, to understand the meaning of such words, I am who am. He who is has sent me to you. I am has sent me to you. The Lord, therefore, put aside what humans could not comprehend and added what they could. For he said also besides, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. This you can comprehend, for I am who I am, what mind can comprehend? That I am who I am is enigmatic is instructive. It doesn't mean that we can't know anything about God, because immediately after this, the name, the Lord, is given. We can know God, the Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But this is God we are coming to know, after all, the creator of the universe, who could choose not to be in relationship with God's creation, but, out of mercy and love, delivers the Israelites from Egypt and reveals God's self to Moses and to us. To Augustine, I am identifies how God as creator is thoroughly different from anything created. We, you and I, cannot simply say I am and be finished, because our lives are fully dependent upon others outside of us, our parents, for instance, grandparents, and so on. And more importantly, our lives are dependent on God. Our lives themselves are gifts. We are contingent, mortal. In this season, we remember that we are dust, and to dust we shall return. But not so God. God is not mortal, and for Augustine, God does not change. This is important in relationship to this passage. Now, the idea of the unchangeability of God to us might sound lifeless, boring, static, powerless, or even oppressive, problematic. But to Augustine, it's life-giving. God's changelessness enables God to be constantly alive, constantly drawing the world to God's self, constantly loving that which God has created. In the Book of Common Prayer, the Episcopal Church, there's a Compline prayer, a prayer for late evening. It says this: "Be present, O merciful God, and protect us through the hours of this night, so that we who are wearied by the changes and chances of this life may rest in your eternal changelessness." In reflecting on this prayer in the Episcopal Relief and Development's Lenten booklet of meditations, someone named Molly F. James asks, "How am I called to engage in transformation in my own life and in my community? We are called to heal a hurting world, but the changes and chances, the magnitude of the hurts of the world can be overwhelming. Where do we begin? First and foremost, we can trust in God's eternal changelessness. We can trust that even when times are dark or we feel weighed down by the needs of the world, we are not alone. God is with us. God is steadfast, loving, caring, and guiding. God does not change. We can abide in God. We are called to witness to and participate in God's transformation of the world. But as the world changes, towards God's will or away from it, God does not change. God is always good, always active, always transforming the world, always drawing creation to God's self. God declares, "I am who I am," to Moses, and provides two names by which God can be known: "I am," and "the Lord God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." God is beyond all names, unlike anything or anyone in the world, and yet God gives God's self to us. God condescends to reveal God's self to humanity in a form that Moses and the Israelites, in a form we can understand. Augustine understands Exodus 3, 14, and 15 according to the drama of Revelation that is also in Christ, who was in the form of God, but did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited. God, who is, who has declared, "I am who I am," is invisible, eternal, not knowable as people or things are knowable. But this God does not stand far off from us, but rather enters our world and enables us to know God. Exodus 3 involves a series of shifts in perception for Moses. First, he shifts from seeing a bush burning to hearing God's call. Then there's a shift from Moses' focus on his own lack of power before Pharaoh to paying attention to God's presence with him. Finally, there is a shift from the need for a name for God to the God who is named, not exhausted by this name. These shifts in perception all point to the reality that the God to whom Moses relates is the creator of all, who is both truly present in the means by which God has given us to know God, and yet also exceeds these means. Some questions for us. Are we paying attention? Is God also shifting our perception from our own power to God's presence with us, guiding our attention through the means by which we know God to the God whom we know? I have, for the last 20 minutes, directed us to attend closely to the words of this scriptural passage. This is one important way that we can pay attention, one specific and important means that God has given us to know God. God uses these humble words and all of their humanness to draw us toward God, to shape our hearts, minds, and actions in accordance with God's will. I hope that, like me, in these words, you have also encountered the God of Moses, the God who is and who is with us.
Thank you. the God who